Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Dispatches. This afternoon, we are in Boulder, Colorado, at the Dorje Kassin office of the Shambhala Center. And we have with us today Cynthia Moku, who is a visual artist and a painter, and someone that this whole week I hounded Walter and said, I want to talk to Cynthia, I want to talk to Cynthia. And we had a ridiculous schedule already, and there really was no time, but there was a cancellation. And I am very happy that Cynthia was able to actually move her schedule and come be here with us, because I am enormously curious about the work that she is doing. So Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Julia.
Cynthia, tell me a little bit about how you met your teacher, who your teacher is, how it was in terms of Buddha Dharma. Tell me a little bit about your spiritual path, how you started.
Okay, well, you can see from my face, it's going back a ways. Actually, in 1973, I met Kala Rinpoche, Kyabje Kala Rinpoche. And, but before that, I had been training quite a bit in the Theravadin tradition of meditation. And this was in California, in Marin County, and then San Francisco. And I had done a few retreats, two-week and three-week type retreats that were done in that tradition, which those are fairly strict in a certain way, the form. You know, the gong would ring at 4 in the morning. We would be up to practice. There wouldn't be any eating or even drinking, actually, after noon. In the very basic practices of breathing and then putting your attention on the body, the sensations. So it was a very much direct experience. Anyway, so then Kala Rinpoche came, and I had the opportunity to sit with him in his room. And I asked him a question then that he gave an answer to me that I realized right on the spot. I realized that this man, this old man, wearing these, you know, maroon robes, knows the true nature of reality. And he knows answers to questions I haven't even thought of yet. And I realized later, much later actually, in my practice and study, that what had occurred then between Kala Rinpoche and I was pointing out instruction.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. When they say that he, she, who is your teacher, is he, she, who shows you the nature of mind. And somehow, karmically speaking, that's how you know who your teacher is.
Yeah.
Did you go to Vancouver, or did he relocate to San Francisco? Where did you do most of your path?
Well, with Kala Rinpoche, he first came to Vancouver in 73. That was his first landing in the Northern America. And then a few weeks later, he came to San Francisco. And when he came that first time, but about five of us actually started the San Francisco Center, Kagyu Drudin Kunchab. So we didn't have a resident lama yet. We would get one later. So I was one of those first initial people, and I became the secretary of Kagyu Drudin Kunchab. And the Berkeley Dharma Datu was happening in the meantime, and so I never went to Vancouver. I mean, I did go to Vancouver, but I stayed in San Francisco.
Did you have a visual arts training? How did it all begin to unfold that your curiosity for Dharma somewhat blended with your artistry?
Right. Well, ever since I was little, very little, I've been drawing. That seemed to be, you know, the way that, and I do, I feel completely at home communicating in that way. I feel that's where my strength lies. So my mother was brilliant enough and kind enough to give me oil paints when I was 6, including turpentine and the whole business. And so I played around, and I used to draw. I love the classical drawing training, which I took later in college, but as a child, I would take images from National Geographics and draw them, because the photographs of people were so good. So just as a child, I was always doing that, and also writing poetry, my sister and I. My mother came from a European background. She was European and trained in very classical ways in the arts and languages and so forth, humanities. I was in San Francisco because I was going to the San Francisco Academy of Art and the Art Institute. The Academy is a bit more professional oriented, although they have a fine art department. The Art Institute was completely, and at that time in the late 60s, it was completely, completely wild.
How did you learn Tibetan iconography? How did you...
Yeah. What happened was when I met Colin Rinpoche and we decided before he left that we would start a Dharma center, and I became one of the five people to move into this center and get things started. At the same time, Glenn Eddy,
yes,
who many people know, who just passed, was in Berkeley. Yeah, Glenn Eddy had passed.
Oh, goodness.
Passed away. He was in Berkeley. And he had just a few months before that started doing drawings for Tartang Tulku, and then Trungpa Rinpoche eventually asked him. But at this point, Tartang Tulku was the one who asked him to do things. Glenn was a great draftsperson. And what Tartang was doing was having Glenn take rice block prints, of which there were plenty at that time, and trace them and correct them and redo them because they were so crude. And I believe that Glenn did learn a few, it's called the Tigse, the basic proportions of the Buddha figure, which are very, very important, most important. So Glenn offered to come to Kagyu Dorden Kunjab, our center of Kala Rinpoche's, a few months after we had started to teach, you know, how to draw the Buddha, if people were interested. And my boyfriend, who became my husband then, Kala Rinpoche's attorney, lawyer, Joseph Duane, he was very interested in this, being a good artist himself. And really, Joe was the one who said, let's do this, you know. So I said, sure, I was kind of curious. I had seen Tonka paintings now that I had been around the Tibetans, you know, hanging in the shrine room. And I wasn't too particularly attracted to them. And I didn't know a whole lot about visualization at that point, right? So Glenn came, and I remember, this was very significant for me. It was another transmission time. At one point, Glenn was sitting down, and Glenn was very casual about the way he taught. Things were happening in his life, too, all kinds of things. But he showed us the graph, or the Tigse, the proportions of the Buddha face. And this is what we were going to learn to draw. And I could immediately recognize, because I've been doing architectural rendering for years now, you know, I could see that. That was not a problem, the proportions, and that was interesting. But then he took a very fine brush. Tonka painting is done with fine brushes, and he showed us the inking practice, in which you dip the brush in ink and you make a line over the work you've done, the drawing, that is to be very even and fluid. But what I noticed when I saw Glenn do that, I suddenly saw complete freedom of expression in a form that was very disciplined. And that totally captivated me. Because in art school at the time, especially at the Institute, freedom of expression was not being pursued through disciplined art forms. But I just saw in Glenn's hand such freedom, and I knew it was in his mind, heart mind. And that, I went, cool. I want to try this.
A tremendous freedom in the tradition.
In a very precise form.
I've always wanted to know, because I've never had anybody that I could really ask, what is the story about the eyes of the Tonka? They need to be painted by somebody, or the eyes in the statues, or like the Sakyam put the eyes in the... There's something about the eyes.
Yeah, very much so. Again, traditionally, when an image is painted, first of all, the eyes, particularly the pupils of the eye, are done last. It's like the primordial dot, really. And when the pupils go into any image, even if it's a piece of Western art, right away, that image is awake. So in that sense, traditionally, always the master painter of a school or the lama or Rinpoche of the monastery or the situation would put the eye, the pupils in after everything was finished, everything else was ready. And sometimes it would just be symbolic, not just, that doesn't mean a diminishing it, but for instance, like the eyes of the Mahakala statue, the form Mahakala in the stupa, I was working on it because I did the paintings there of the wrathful ones, and I was working on the eyes, and the Sakyong came up unexpectedly. And when he did, I just took the opportunity then to ask him. It felt appropriate. I said, Rinpoche, would you put the eyes in? And he said, yes, I will. And there were just a few people with us. And so he said, get it ready. And he went upstairs. And then when he came back down, he put in the dot for each one. And then he said to me afterwards, go ahead and finish and, you know, fill them in as you see fit. But the fact that he put those two dots in is empowering, just like with the Buddha. So that's the what you're referring to, I think.
Yes.
It's not always done that way now, but that's a very significant transmission when that can happen in that way.
It becomes somewhat non-dual mind, as you're saying, the primordial dot.
Well, yeah, it's the Lama, him or herself, the enlightened master, waking up the image. So it's a direct transmission of him, of, you know, consecrating this image.
Interesting. In the firmament of teachers that you mentioned came through your center.
Yeah.
The Trungpa Rinpoche comet trail by at one point, or how did you through his wake?
Yeah, no, Trungpa Rinpoche comet didn't just trail by. He came right to our center. He came one afternoon, early evening. And he sat with us while we did Chenrezig practice at the shrine. He sat, you know, like the Lama. And I remember my personally feeling like he was so kind. I felt so much love and just really kind of like a joy around coming from him. And I also at the same time felt like he was carrying a tremendous burden, but it wasn't a burden. You know, literally, like he was holding so much, but he was in full enjoyment. And that captivated me. So he sat with us, and he said, this is wonderful what you're doing. Keep practicing. And we were practicing in Tibetan. We had a very, you know, set schedule. And then a couple other times I got to be again, close with him in that way, both delivering messages to him from Kala Rinpoche, written messages, where I just sat and had some tea, and there were other people in the room. And again, I felt the same kind of just the seat, like I was in the heart of loving kindness.
Did you ever share your work with him, or did he ever see your painting, or did you ever talk to him about it? Or?
Right. Well, I never spent more time with him in that way. I did once go to one of his early, or attempt to go to one of his early talks in Berkeley, and actually, I left, only because, and now I laugh, and I see that when I got there, there were many people in suits, and with pins and so on, but the atmosphere for me was so much that I didn't know anybody here, and clearly the way you got in was to know people. It had that kind of atmosphere. I'm not saying anything negative about it, but I just was like, I didn't go to try to penetrate that. And I felt actually, because of these meetings I'd had with Trungpa, so close in his heart. So I hadn't read his books. That came later. But in terms of my work, there was a long period of time, or quite a bit, where when I, as a student of Kala Rinpoche, or during that time I was, and I studied with other teachers because they would visit us, you know. I wasn't looking for other teachers, and I was completely doing the Tonka painting as traditionally, so to speak, as the way I learned. So I was investigating a lot. I was drawing dakinis, I was drawing, you know, yabiums. I was doing things that were being requested. And again, I wasn't doing a ton of work because I was a mom, a young mother. So I see that period of my life as being a period of staying very close to the tradition and just continuing to do it. And then it was a very significant point in my life where I decided to combine my training as a Western artist with the training now in that way. And that's when Trungpa Rinpoche had a very, very tangible effect again.
And what happened at that time?
Well, what happened was I ended up moving to Boulder. But before I did, I was invited to paint at the stupa in Santa Fe, Kala Rinpoche's stupa. And what was interesting about that, I'd never painted murals in a stupa, you know. And in fact, I didn't even really know what a stupa looked like. I mean, come on, you know. And so my parents lived in Albuquerque, and I came from San Francisco. And with my kids, too, they were young at the time. And I went to paint for a week. And my dad and I drove past the stupa a couple times because
I was
expecting, well, first of all, it was set back from the road, dirt road. Right now it's no longer dirt, but dirt road. It was set back, and it was in construction, under construction. So it was cinder blocks and, you know, it looked like a construction pit. And I was expecting a Taj Mahal. So Dad, you know, so then finally I realized, and as many people know who have seen the Santa Fe stupa of Kala Rinpoche's, it's right by the trailer parks. And I realized, oh, this is it. And then when I was taken inside and Lama Dorje was the resident Lama, I suddenly realized I was literally facing the wall and realizing I was just going to have to paint with what I knew. There were no more props. Now, Sanjay, who was painting also and was the head of this project, had brought Xeroxes of Tonkas and so forth. But there was a lot that we had to, you know, fix and adjust. And Sanjay, you know, just said, Cynthia, you know, let's do this. And suddenly I was up against the wall. And then I started to see, like, wait a minute, I do know things. I do recognize things. But it wasn't so much like it was more just the doing of it. And people came to help us, and we would guide them. And then at that point, I met Paul Kloppenberg, who's one of Trungpa Rinpoche's students, and I became more interested, and other people too, actually, in his sangha. I became more curious about their practice and his teachings, because obviously they had a different sort of approach. And that's when I read Journey Without Goal over time. But because of that stupa, I was inspired to then draw my Tsawe Lama, Kala Rinpoche, in a more traditional Western portrait-like form, but incorporating not only the symbolic content of Tonkas on the outer level, but the inner meaning. And so I realized that, number one, I needed to draw him based on the Tigse of the Buddha. And it became a very interesting exercise for me. And all of my artwork is this. I'm always investigating when I do work. It became a very interesting investigation to draw the Tigse of the Buddha, and then as a Western artist, draw a portrait within that of a Lama. So the Tigse became like the ground of Dharmakaya, in which I could then actually draw this individual. And I did that, and then I turned to Trungpa Rinpoche and decided I wanted to do a portrait of him. And by that time, I had come to Boulder. I had been invited to come and teach a little bit about Tonka painting as a guest teacher. It was an institute then. But now I was moved to Boulder, and I was doing a little bit more at Naropa. We're just talking about months now. And then Sanjay, who was teaching calligraphy and Tibetan Tonka painting and different things with very few other people. I think Barbara Bash was there. He moved, and he asked me if I would. There was no visual art department, really. There was no visual art degree program. And he asked me if I would sort of take his place. And I did as a Tonka painting teacher, but also I was extremely inspired to begin a visual art degree program. Because coming from outside of the Shambhala context, Naropa had a huge, really, aura about it. And if you weren't in it, people really, wow, Naropa, you know. And when I got there, I was shocked. It was this little brick building, and literally the art program, which I thought was going to be huge because Trungpa Rinpoche was such an artist, was tiny. Not much really was happening. And I was just like, what? So I just got very inspired, and there were three things that I felt were like a tripod for this institute where an actual visual art BA degree program could be offered. One was meditation. One was, you know, coming to know your mind, calm abiding practice, which is not offered in art institutions, especially, you know, that time. The other was a very thorough and full training in techniques of art, which would be both Western and then also Eastern. And that was also something that people could not find in a regular art training program. So I worked for a long time. I worked for nearly 7 years to get this program going. And that was a very amazing time. It was very frustrating in a sense and very hard because I was a new kid on the block.
What years were these?
I came to Boulder in 1987, and the program opened in 1994.
Oof, wow.
Yeah. And so from like 87, I was invited to teach 87 and 88 in the summer. 89 I came in, and so I was a new kid on the block, but I was teaching Tonka painting. And I started being more vocal about, you know, I started writing out a whole design. And so I was being, Barbara Dilley was president, Pearl Olson was vice president of academic affairs. And they were curious, particularly Pearl, being, you know, dean of the academics, was interested. And one person at that time who's now gone, Jim Spearley, I remember him so well because, I wasn't being paid for any of this, so partly, you know, that was why, you know, too. I had the enthusiasm, I had the interest, and I was being invited into the faculty meetings as the person who was holding visual arts, you know, barely at the institute to see what we could do. And I started designing, I could see it in my mind, designing a program that I felt would work. In 1994, it started. We got funding. So I invited and hired, basically, Robert Spillman, Joan Anderson, you know, they're both still teaching. Eiichi Okamoto Sensei, who I hope, you know, will come back at someday. I'm very close to Eiichi. These people, Lori Doctor had been teaching there for a long time, Western calligraphy, she stayed. And as chair of the department then, I was teaching Tonka painting. I was teaching a class that I designed called a contemplative artist, which is still ongoing. And has, you know, morphed, as it should, and Joan has taught it, Robert has taught it. I was teaching color theory. You know, I got back into that kind of way of the rest, the Western arts and the Eastern. But the students came. We needed six, we got six, and then the next year more came. And so I stayed with it for 2.5, almost 3 years as the chair. So I stepped back, and Robert Spellman took the chairship. And to this day, I still teach, and I teach in other programs too, but I'm teaching minimally as what they call a senior adjunct professor, which means an aging adjunct. But I love my connection with Naropa, even though it's both a love-hate relationship, you know. But it's because I could be in that academic creative setting in those early years developing this program, which I felt was completely founded in the principles of Chogyam Trungpa, Trungpa's creativity, and at the same time, I had no doubt about the basic, fundamental, traditional ground that I personally felt he was coming from.
And it seems like your entire life has had this quality of collaborative work and search for both synthesis and authenticity.
Wow, thank you. That's beautiful. You said it very well. I've been wondering how to put it. No, it's true. It really is true.
And I think that perhaps one of the things that you probably share with many of the older students is that for a certain moments in your life, you were also a spiritual widow because your teacher died.
Yeah. In fact, Kala Rinpoche passed away when I came here to Boulder, and I was pregnant with our son, Sean, Paul, my fourth child. He's now 17. But I remember so well, this was another, for me, an introduction into your Sangha. We came up here, I came up here to the shrine called the Dzong, which I still kind of do, the Shambhala Center here in Boulder. And there was a Sukhavati, you know, an honoring of Kala Rinpoche. And I must admit, the forms that all of you were so engaged in, I just found them absolutely beautiful, really. So people were lined up, you know, and there was the practice and the big gong, and then people were invited at the end to say things about Kala Rinpoche, anybody who want, right? And the way Trungpa Rinpoche had you come forth in front of a group of people and, you know, really speak your heart and elocute, you know, that was really amazing, and it was daunting, you know. I mean, and the Tibetan-like sanghas were much more casual, kind of home-like, you know. So there I was sitting, and I was out to here pregnant, and which means I was in my final month. And there was silence for a while, and then one person came up, you know. And then I realized that perhaps nobody in this room had the opportunity to be with him like I had. So I swallowed my
terror,
and I stood up, and it was Mother's Day. And I walked to the microphone, and I did speak about him, and I thanked everybody at the end for doing this and for honoring him. And then I said at the end, I remember this clearly because many people came up to me later. I said, and particularly I thank you, not that we're getting together like this now, but that our intention is that his work, his activity, continues, you know, in whatever way that is. So, you know, that means if you're, as you're a Trungpa student, that doesn't mean you're not continuing the activity of the mind of Kala Rinpoche. So I did it, you know, and then I sat down. And I think partly I had a really good thing going because I was so pregnant. Everybody was just sort of like softened. But then later, you know, people came up and mentioned to me. And I realized that, which I did at Naropa over and over, that despite all the terror and the really uncomfortable times I would have when I knew people were questioning me and, you know, on such a fundamental level, like, who's she to be here, that I was being asked to just be who I was, and I was being asked to speak more, and I was very sensitive and attuned to the forms that were being shown to me. And I wanted to honor those, and I, you know, knew fundamentally this was more of Kala Rinpoche with Trungpa Rinpoche, like they were holding hands for me.
There's a interesting connection also between Kala Rinpoche, Trungpa Rinpoche, and Sakyamuni Rinpoche's work.
Yeah.
And even though the scholars are still debating about it, but just from a pedestrian point of view, which is the only viewpoint I can bring in, when many of us received Kala Chakra initiation from Kala Rinpoche.
Right.
And for us pedestrians, yet again, let the scholars discuss it, there is some relationship between Kala Chakra and Shambhala. And you being...
Excuse me.
I was like, I'm not going to get into that argument, but us pedestrians, you know. The you know... And it's so interesting coincidence that it should be a Kala Rinpoche student who is the person that entered many of us into the Kala Chakra initiation is now being asked by Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche to begin to develop the iconographical language that will give an entryway to his students, to the teachings that he's receiving and the teachings that he's giving. In it's almost like through your artwork, people will actually experience the pupil, that entry point,
to
what Sakyamuni Rinpoche.
Of the eye.
Yeah.
That's a very beautiful metaphor, really, image you have created. Yeah, you could tell by the way I sat up that I could talk about for a long time. I love it. I was there here in Boulder when Kala Rinpoche gave the Kala Chakra initiation. And as we all know, very few Rinpoches were empowered to do that initiation. I mean, the Kala Chakra is what it is. I mean, it's all time and space, you know, like there's not much left in our relative world that's not right. It's amazing. And so this has been very interesting for me, too, to see, again, for myself, the Shambhala teachings and the teachings of the Buddha Dharma are not any different. But I could see through the Shambhala training practices and so on that Trungpa Rinpoche, again, his level of skill was that of a completely realized being. I mean, it was amazing. So, I came into Boulder at the time when things were very divided. It was very difficult for people. It was painful. And I had a great deal of compassion arousing me for that. And then the separation between Shambhala and the Buddha Dharma and the Sakyong, of course, yeah, I mean, they're not. But the techniques are definitely skillful means. Now, the fact that Trungpa Rinpoche himself asked Kala Rinpoche to empower, do this, yeah, we're now going to more and more start finding out why. And also, as, Cassell here and I have been so fortunate to receive the Sangwe Nimpo, the Guhyagarbha teachings, these, again, are just, and I'm speaking for myself, maybe not really, but they are, again, confirming for us and showing us how the Kala Chakra is so connected with Shambhala. We can't even say so connected. I mean, they just are. First of all, the Buddha imparted these teachings to Dawa Zangpo, and left them contained in the kingdom of Shambhala. Now, what Trungpa Rinpoche did in terms of this more secular approach, I feel was an amazing amount of skillful means. And I'm so grateful to the Sakyong in a sense that he's taking that really huge leap to say, okay, let's come back together again. I know that's causing a tremendous amount of questioning and trouble for some people, but we don't have the time right now for me to go into it, but when I have been able to go to different centers and talk, for instance, about the Rigyan image, we get into those things and we're able to talk about it so that you can see the primordial Rigyan is not, we're not taking down Vajradhara from our shrines and putting up the primordial Rigyan. And of course on a physical level, maybe, that is what people are doing, but it's not what is the meaning of it, and it's not what is happening in our hearts and minds if we understand a little bit more about it. They are disguised messengers of creative freedom. I have said this before, and we could talk about this at length, but disguised in that it's a language that if we come to understand it more, people will understand that connection. So, I think that's the main thing now that I feel I can perhaps, again, even make a deeper commitment to the Sakyong, but also become more, part of the Sangha is to talk about those things, to talk about those images and how this change is a change, and yet it's not at the same time.
When you talked about us being a senior adjunct and from the point of view of being an older adjunct, it made me sort of reflect on what you've been saying, that you have, at different times, you've been at the gateway of the Shambhala Vajradhatu Mandala. And, there have been people with their pins and so on and so forth. And it's like fully formed realities, fully, fully, fully formed realities. And you have touched into it at different times and seen it in different times of conflict. But this time you walked in.
Well, this time, the Sakyong, I walked in only because of the graciousness of the Sakyong Mipa Rinpoche inviting me in. And we'd seen each other, obviously, you know, at Shambhala Mountain Center, and I'd been painting and so on and so forth. And actually, I did, when I first came to Boulder, I went to a Sadhana Mahamudra practice. I was invited, you know, asked to come, and I went. And I thought everybody was going to be there, because he was Trungpa Rinpoche's son. And in a regular Tibetan-type center, there'd be no question, you know, zoom, he's the one. And there were about 25 people. And he was young, you know, and the region situation was going on for people. And I was surprised. But I went in to sit down at Marpa House, and then someone, a Kasung, came forward. And this was new to me, too, in a way. And it happened to be Acharya Azrael, and we laugh about that now because we are so connected. Anyway, and she bowed, and I kind of looked up. I was, and she just simply said, "Are you a sadhaka?" I didn't even know what that meant. Now, if she had said, "Are you a practitioner of Vajrayana Buddhism, or do you practice?" You know, I would have gotten. But we didn't use the Sanskrit word, so I kind of obviously looked. And then she said, "Could you please come with me for a moment? I have to ask you some questions." So we went out, and she basically asked me what my name was, my practice, and that she needed to let the Sakyong know he was upstairs. And to be asked what your practice is completely a shock. You don't do that in most places. So, but I told her very minimally, and 10 minutes, she went up to the Sakyong, and then he was a Sawang then, and 10 minutes later she came down and she said, "The Sawang, said, you're welcome, he's happy you're here." And I went, you know, and then I didn't see him again for a while. And then I went to the Guhyagarbha teachings, particularly the last series that Kenpo Namdral was giving on Longchenpa's commentary, Dispelling the Darkness of Ignorance. And I didn't even know the Sakyong was going to be there. I mean, I've been teaching and all, you know, but I wasn't in on that kind of communication. And when I arrived, then, you know, obviously, and he was there. And I remember, actually, I came a couple days later, and I was sitting in the shrine room early in the morning when I got there to practice a little. And the Sakyong came in. And I remember, we stood up, and I remember seeing him. And he looked at me, and he kind of got a little grin on his face. And under his breath, I heard him because we were so close. He just said, "Oh, it's you." Because he, you know, and I felt, oh, great, he does recognize me, you know. But then during that time, I actually, we did speak with each other. And that was when I realized that something was happening here for me. And I wanted to study with the Sakyong. And it was like, it was very different from Kala Rinpoche. But I was meeting once again, like Kala Rinpoche, an embodied teacher for me. And I was surprised, but I decided to go with it. And then Rinpoche invited me to go to Kalapa Assembly, which I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I didn't know that you went through all these things before you went to Kalapa Assembly. So when I had to go online, and when I got the form, pages and pages of when did you do this, what year did you do that, you know. And I left it all blank. But then when it got, the last question was, can you describe what you've perhaps done or contributed in the Sangha? And then I wrote quite a few pages. And the form went in, and of course David Brown had let them know, the Sakyong had invited me. So then I went to Kalapa Assembly. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was the rainy one in Nova Scotia. And again, though,
that could be many of them,
through
okay?
All the forms, for me anyway, I could see, like even the Werma practice, which I'm doing now, Kala Rinpoche gave only a few of us a practice. It was the only thing he gave us in English that for me, I'm not going to go into detail, but for me, I see this beautiful connection between Werma and what Kala Rinpoche gave us. And so, you know, what can I say? My heart feels so full now, like it's going to break. That Sakyong and Kala Rinpoche, I can't say overtly, they're, you know, the same, but there's definitely
continuity
for me. There's definitely that, and then that's how the Sakyong and I made that connection.
What was the mandate that Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche gave you in terms of painting a tanka of his terma, of his teachings.
The Sakyong, it's interesting, we put things into terms like mandates and command and the ka in all of this because...
Request, supplication.
Yeah, well, because sometimes I think these words, then we feel that they hold so much power inherently that we feel that there's a bigger deal around it. And actually, when Rinpoche has been speaking to me about the images, it's been very simple, very spacious, very loving, and intangible in the sense that
it's collaborative.
Well, it's collaborative in the sense, yeah, and again, I feel like I'm going to make this statement. For myself, my experience with Rinpoche, for instance, with the Rigdon King, I had no idea, again, that apparently he had been talking about this or had here and there throughout the years mentioned some type of image and even talked about it with other painters, I think, and David Brown and, senior people. It seemed like something was cooking for him. I didn't know that. When Rinpoche asked me to come to Kalapa Assembly, I did see him a few times. And at one point, when he invited me to come to one of the thank you parties he was giving for his staff, that's, like we'd be sitting around, and then Rinpoche would I'd be sitting near him, and he'd say, Cynthia, and he would just talk, and he never really described the Rigdon. But that first time he mentioned to me, I knew, and he didn't use the words primordial Rigdon or anything, I knew, I could see it in his face, for one, and I knew that he was talking about something that was cooking for him deeply, and I don't feel I'm the only one, other people had experienced that. But here he was speaking to me, and I knew it was as a tanka painter. And he had seen some of my work I had shown him, both contemporary, because I do other types of work, and, so he was very interested. He had seen it in Hawaii. So then the next time, a few months later, he came to Boulder, and he was at Naropa giving a talk, and afterwards people were able to see him. And I was there, and I sat down next to him. And when people were sitting with him, there was a big crowd. People were kind of milling around, but you had a little bit of kind of privacy, sort of. And at that point, Rinpoche, and again, we're just talking. Like, hello, how are you? This is nice. And not much. It's very spacious. And then he says to me, I'd like you to paint this image. And I knew he was talking, I didn't have to ask him, but I did clarify. I said, Rinpoche, are you talking about the image that, you were briefly describing? And we hadn't even come yet to a primordial Rigdon name. And then I said to him, he said yes, and I said, Rinpoche, that's a fairly significant project, because I knew he wanted to introduce this. I mean, I knew it without him saying it, and this was going to cause a huge stirring of the pot. And I asked him, I said, this is going to, really stir things up. I said, are you sure you want a Western woman to do this? And then he looked at me, right at me, and he said, yes, I'd like you to do this, Cynthia. And that, again, that was a his heart was just there. And I knew that he was trusting me in a way, and I was ready to do that. So when I drew the Rigdon, when I first drew the image, it took me a few months, and then I sent it off before the Losar, and he got to see it in Halifax. I knew that Rinpoche was describing, not even describing isn't the right word, was fundamentally, there was something he was seeing in his own heart and mind, his awakened mind as Rinpoche, as Mipham, an image that was expressing all the kayas, that was expressing Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. So the Dharmakaya aspect, which is, can be shown by Vajradhara, it can be shown by Vajrasattva, it can be shown primordially by Kunti Tsongpo and Kunti Tsongpo, Samantabhadri, as you said. Obviously the Sambhogakaya form, and then the Nirmanakaya being the form here on earth. Now, most of the time, people have seen rigged in kings that are looking more like Indian siddhas. And this is one way they can be shown. And Nudra and his painters have done beautiful, exquisite tangas that are around. But I knew that Rinpoche wasn't looking to show this particular aspect. And I figured I'd be drawn quite a bit. But when I drew that first primordial Rigdon image, I drew it in a way that would incorporate these things from what I knew. And also, I drew one thing Rinpoche had said to me, the environment I wanted, it should be rich.
Kalu Rinpoche?
No, the Sakyam Rinpoche. The environment of the Rigdon needs to be rich. And that means all the elements are there. You know, tiger, lion, Garuda, dragon, of course, but that it had a feeling of this fullness, this richness. And again, I recognized, you know, his, at least I'm talking about my own experience, of course, I recognized his message now is so much about this uplifted quality and this really the quality of Ratna, that we're not impoverished, we're not shortchanged. This is the primordial Rigdon, and it's here in the world. And when he saw the drawing, he really loved it. And one thing I knew for sure was that this image was going to be traditional Buddha Tiksai and needed to look like the Buddha face. You know what I mean? That face of complete awakening. And so, you know, that's how I started drawing.
As you're walking into this project, I couldn't help but somewhat chuckle when you said that the Sakyong looks at you and says, yes, I want you to do it. And you said, well, this is going to create some, stir up some issues. Me, a Western woman. And I realized that what you're referring to is the male Eastern Takan painters also being freaked out about it. Not to mention all the Trungpa Rinpoche students are going to be freaked out about their own reasons.
And the painters in America, there aren't that many, of course. I mean, really, you know, you can name us on one hand, you know, Greg, myself, you know. But, no, I wanted just to make sure for myself that Rinpoche was indeed asking me to do this. Not that I doubted him, but more that it wasn't just about doing this. This was a big thing,
statement.
And I recognized that. And that in accepting to do it, which then when I did say to him, I accept Rinpoche and I'm honored, that he knew that I was accepting the whole ball game, the path of what this would mean. And obviously, you know, this would be interesting both on the Eastern and the Western seaboards.
What is coming down the pike for you? There, you have other commissions, and we were talking at the before the show that it would be really easy if it were a commission. This is not quite a commission, and even though it's being presented to you in a very gentle, collaborative work, it is certainly a karmic elephant. How many elephants are coming down the pike?
Yeah. Rinpoche has asked me to do quite a list of things. Or, you know, he'll say, oh, I'd like you to do this if you can. And some of them are more going into my contemporary work. Like, for instance, I'm working now, I'm finishing a portrait of he and Khandro Tseong. And in the series that I've been doing ongoing since 85, which many people now have seen, the Trungpa Rinpoche image that was in the Shambhala Sun and so on. So I'm doing that. But also, in terms of the practice for the Shambhala Sangha, the biggest thing is he started talking with me about the whole lineage tree. So in the practice of the Nundro that he's given us, all of those deities.
It's a lot of relatives.
Yeah, yeah. And then, but before that, of course, the Yeshe Tsogyal came, and that is being worked on. And
is it a tanka of specifically Yeshe Tsogyal? A banner.
A banner hung in the shrines, shrine rooms, of the feminine principle holding that place. And then there's also Shiva Okar, which he it's been a year now that he first wanted me to start doing an image of Shiva Ocar, that some people have seen the drawing or stages of the drawing, and again, that's causing a bit of a stir for you know, even very senior acharyas even, and then for many people, it's they can't wait till it's finished. Part of my situation is that we're trying to figure out how I can do this work and be compensated to live the life I need to live to do it. And so Ben Moore, who's the director of Shambhala Media, all the Shambhala publications, archives, and so on, he's basically that business person. We've been talking just actually this morning again. But this is a very crucial thing right now, because for almost 2 years, or 3 years, 2.5 years, I have been working without any clear, and I basically, you know, we can't continue that way. So we're looking into that, and anybody who wants to find out more about it can. And then also,
where should they?
Well, either they could, you know, email me, or they could email Ben Moore.
And your email is?
CM, my initials, at CMOKU, CMOKU.com. That's how I sign my work. And then Ben also is, Rinpoche actually has asked him, you know, mandated to him, let's do what we can do to have Cynthia be able to do these things.
And Ben Moore can be contacted through Vajradhatu Publications, I think.
I should know it. Bmore or Ben Moore at Shambhala Shop, or if you
Shambhala
go to
Shop, okay.
Vajradhatu Pubs, that
in
Halifax. Oh yeah. Anyway, so that's, you know, one very real aspect that has to get put into place so that I can continue doing these things. You know, we can continue getting these things out. And Rinpoche, he really wants to see this happening. And I know many people are wondering about the shrine and all of this, but there are stages that have to happen, because Rinpoche, he is seeing a whole environment that people walk into. So, you know, he's talked to me about the banners, the finials for the banners, the actual tops of the banners, how they'll be, the crystal Norbu, designs for the symbols of the Chakravartin. All of these things I've been doing sketches and working on, but it's on hold in a sense, because we need ways to have this really both supporting me but also happening and coming out, you know, appropriately. And like, for instance, the symbols of the Universal Monarch, it's really great. These are symbols that are expressly for, like, the Rigdon Kings. And Rinpoche would like to see these become, just like symbolic language, something, yeah, like you see a vajra and you get a sense of what it is, or you see a lotus, and now throughout the world people see a lotus and they, you know, at least think Buddhism, you know. Well, when we talked about these, I brought in our conversation with Rinpoche, this, what you're talking about is an international graphic language. Mm-hmm. This is a field that is, it's called way showing. Now, how's that for a dharmic word? And it's basically the language of international road signs, the language of moving people through great, big areas like airports. And so I was very inspired by that kind of design, and I know a bit about it, and I've designed now these symbols to hold that quality of both being sort of like a Japanese seal, but also have the contemporary quality of way showing.
They're visual archetypes.
They're visual archetypes.
And they take you to specific realities.
Yeah.
One says, you know, do not enter, and you know that means do not enter. And one says, you know, cow.
Or one says, maybe it's the symbol, it's coral, the precious queen. But at some point, people will be able to see this symbol and immediately connect it with...
to that reality.
...dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Direct reality, if you know you're at that stage really of development, but even just dignity.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia, I want to fundamentally thank you for being one of the Aryan riches of Sakyamnipa Rinpoche. And in some way, he has his precious queen, and he is trying to gather his generals, and he's trying to gather his ministers. Mm. And having an editor it's important having someone to help with feng shui and space, and having, as a term that I used in our previous conversation, a court painter, both a temporal and spiritual court painter, as someone who expresses through that sort of visual, universal, archetypal language his mind so that other people can enter and rest in it. So I want to thank you for walking through the minefield of the male-female issue, of the Eastern-Western issue, of the older-newer student issue, of the inside-outside issue, and having the daring to take a leap, see what happens.
Well, thank you. I thank my teachers, and I thank Sakyan Rinpoche Rinpoche for sure right now. And I just wanted to say one thing. I just recently became aware of the Chronicles, and it's fabulous. And I don't know all the names of the people who are involved. Casella's here, you were here, Julia.
Walter Fordham.
I know about Walter.
Joanne Fordham.
Joanne, that it's really wonderful. And like we were saying earlier, the stories are so important and so lovely. So I'm honored that you wanted to invite me in.
Well, thank you for honoring the request and for letting us all know the world that you inhabit. Thank you, Cynthia.
You have been listening to ChroniclesRadio.com, a production of the Chronicles of CTR.